share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
It's 12:09. This is WGN. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is here too, our producer, and we're looking at the markets today. The Dow at one point trading up 850 points. The S&P soaring 3.1%. These numbers just a few minutes old, but you get the idea. The NASDAQ rose 2.4%. Let me hit mute on that. The NASDAQ up 2.5%, and it's on a couple of factors. One is that drug company that Steve was talking about, and also Chairman Powell didn't say anything too specific on 60 Minutes, but he did say Sunday night that I would not bet against the American economy. He promised a vaccine trial and that the Fed, I'm now reading from CNN.com, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said the Fed would take more action to stimulate the economy. And it is on those two positive pieces of news, that the market is reacting so strongly today. As you heard, we had Senator Durbin on. Actually, Senator Durbin was traveling today. He was on his way to the airport. He had a long car trip, I think, from Springfield, he said. And as he was listening to the show, he picked up the phone and called, more to chat than do business. But we asked him if he was worried about the amount of money that we continue to give away, another $3 trillion in stimulus. And he said, absolutely not. He said, hell no, this isn't too much. We have to do this, and we'll figure out how to pay for it later. And that was Senator Durbin's reaction to that. It's interesting, too, isn't it, how many new kinds of companies are all of a sudden percolating up? It doesn't fill in the void. I mean, nobody's kidding anybody with this, but it's just interesting to see that now hand sanitizers is a hot category, and face masks are a hot category. Kim Kardashian came out with a Skims, that's the name of the brand, face mask. It sells $8 a piece, and those sold out instantly. Her company is donating a lot of them, but the Kardashians know how to make money even in a pandemic, and they have sold out the Kardashian face masks because not only are they face masks, but they're maybe a little more stylish than what you're wearing. I was out this weekend and saw some people still wearing the light blue cotton hospital type surgical masks, and then other people are sort of morphing into a more of a fashion statement. Have you noticed some people coordinate their face mask with what they're wearing? Speaker Nancy Pelosi does that sometimes. Maybe the ladies are a little more fashion forward. Maybe the wealthy are a little more fashion forward, but I've just noticed at times on TV, and now as I work around town, you will see some people trying to coordinate the thing just a little bit more. And maybe that's a sign, too, that we are getting used to it, that we are going to be more willing to wear these things and protect ourselves and others around us. Boy, that would be the good news. And then one other bit of fashion news before we take a break and then really get rolling with our guests. We'll visit in a moment with Jim Dahlke, the senior editor at Chicago Inno. But I know that Amy Guth is going to talk to us about Air Jordans. Michael Jordan and the Bulls of yore are on people's mind. And what does an original pair of Air Jordans sell for these days? It's more than your house. It's 12:17 on WGM. Jim Dahlke joins us often on Mondays. Today's no exception. Senior editor at Chicago Inno. Jim, welcome back. And I'm interested in seeing that one of your stories today includes news about another food delivery service, a category fairly populated, especially in Chicago, but they've raised some money to do this, huh?
That's right. Hey, John, thanks for having me. Talk is a startup in Chicago, and you know they have built a really interesting business and have been one of the most fascinating sort of pivot stories to watch in the age of COVID-19. So Talk is founded by Nick Kokonis, who is of the Alinea restaurant fame, and Brian Fitzpatrick, who is a former Google engineer here in Chicago. So a really experienced team has created this service that allows folks to book a table at a restaurant, but they operate a little bit differently than, say, OpenTable. So Talk's whole business model is about putting down a deposit to get a coveted seat at a really in-demand restaurant. So as you can imagine, a business that's built around in-dining reservations took a pretty serious hit during the coronavirus. Nobody was going to restaurants, obviously. So, you know, Talk went through a really fascinating business pivot in that it spun up a delivery and takeout service for the restaurants that use its platform. So about early March, in less than a week, it spun up a completely new division of its company and created a delivery service and takeout service for these restaurants that previously really weren't offering that. And it's something that's kept not only a lot of these restaurants in business, but Tock itself has been able to sustain because of this revenue, and just last week raised $10 million in new funding.
It's a free app for me.
So for the user, yes. So the user uses this to get delivery from Alinea, for example. So Alinea has been able to kind of sustain its employees by this service itself, but they work with thousands of restaurants. They added almost 1,000 new restaurants last month alone, and companies who are relying on Tock for food delivery. And, you know, kind of the interesting thing about Tock's food delivery is that they're charging a 3% fee to the restaurant. I'm sure you're aware that, you know, a lot of these third-party delivery apps, whether it be Grubhub or Uber Eats, are taking a much larger chunk in the, 25% range sometimes for these restaurants. So 3% is certainly a much more economical alternative for some of these restaurants who are looking to get into delivery.
Boy, you wonder how they, when we all discovered that they were getting 25, 30% of the bill, I think a lot of people were surprised and maybe outraged. But I don't know how you can make it on 3%. You'd think it would be somewhere in the middle. 3%?
Yeah, so they're saying just 3%. So that's the charge that Tock is offering. And you can imagine that this will be, just one revenue stream for them. Eventually, obviously, restaurants will open back up, and that will continue to be a big part of what they're doing. I mean, Tock's whole thing is really kind of offering really rich software to restaurants. And so, not only will restaurants be able to have this sort of ticketing service for in-restaurant dining, but also have access to this delivery and takeout software as well.
Wow. Okay. So that's called, that app is available now, that service is up and running, I could use that right now?
Oh, yeah. It's operating, it's up and running, and actually since the middle of March, they've handled over 1 million Tock to Go meals, so it's been extremely popular with its restaurants across the country.
Mm. Talk to me a little bit about brands like Lyft and Adidas, which are, my understanding is, finding vacant retail space for ads. What's going on here?
That's right. So those brands are working through a Chicago startup called Visual Feeder. And what Visual Feeder does is really interesting. It's working with landlords to have vacant retail space and sort of turning those window spaces into advertising opportunities for brands like you mentioned, Lyft and Adidas. So what Visual Feeder does is kind of create these really rich visual ads that live right on the window fronts of these empty retail spaces. So they have what they're calling projection mapping technology that creates these really immersive, interactive kind of visual ads. And so Lyft and Adidas have been two of the early companies that have worked with this Chicago startup. But really what they're able to do is kind of provide some additional income to some of these landlords that maybe are having a hard time filling up their retail space.
Jim, you keep talking about all this venture capital. How much has it dropped off? How many fewer dollars are available, either as a percentage or in some way for us to get our head around what's happening in that whole space?
It's a great question. There is absolutely a slowdown in venture capital happening right now. I think what we found was that Q1 was a bit slower than normal. The Q2 numbers obviously won't come out for some time, but it will be a pretty marked drop off, especially in Chicago. I was talking to several VCs. Everybody is, quote unquote, open for business, but pretty much across the board, deal volume is going to slow down. The amount of deals are just not going to be at the pace that they were the previous quarter and certainly at the end of last year. Pretty much every venture capitalist in town is telling you that, they're out looking for deals, they're looking for startups. It's, in some ways a really interesting time to be an investor because, we're going to see a lot of businesses become, more popular than ever as we get into whatever this quote-unquote new normal is, but the amount of startups getting funding is going to definitely drop off, at least in the near term.
I could see how you might want to hold on to your cards a little bit right now, but at some point I think you would want to play them in those areas where businesses are now going to flourish in the new normal, like you say. And I guess the gamble is what are the businesses and what are the sectors, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, Tock is a great example, right? So this is a business that, you know, was able to kind of pivot, create a much needed service for the restaurant industry, and was able to raise $10 million in funding. So I think, you know, good businesses will continue to track venture capital dollars. I think what, you know, types of businesses get funded may change. You know, I think if you are in, you know, the travel industry, those businesses are going to have a hard time raising capital right now, right? Or they're going to be raising capital at maybe much less founder-friendly terms. So, you know, I think that there's a lot still to be learned here, but, you know, one thing is for certain is that, you know, you have to have a business that can be, you know, a little COVID-proof here if you're going to attract venture dollars.
Well, I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse necessarily, but I was thinking about all of the office space downtown Chicago and in other big cities that maybe is going to be less in demand. Maybe some of the tenants aren't even going to come back for all of these reasons. And so the people that are holding those mortgages are really going to suffer. But I could also imagine a scenario where after a relatively short period of time, people realize, A, it's going to be safe to come back, and B, we need to be in a central place. We need people to interact in person and randomly. That's how businesses thrive. So the idea that, oh no, the new normal is going to be everybody works from home, everybody is satellite, may not be true. That's a bet that I'm not comfortable making right now.
Well, it's a good question. And one thing to think about is that just this morning, Uber announced that it's pulling out of 45 offices across the world. So Uber is, you know, going through, you know, thousands of new job cuts, and it's consolidating its retail space, so its real estate space. So, you know, it's going to ditch dozens of satellite offices. So I think that might be a trend, right? So companies will continue to invest in their headquarters, but maybe they'll have less satellite offices. Yeah, I think that the commercial real estate industry is in a really precarious situation right now. I've definitely talked to early stage entrepreneurs who have found that this remote working thing is working better than they thought it would. They're thinking about where to cut costs, and real estate might be some of that.
Although then, ironically, then it does open up office space for the, WeWork spaces, right? Where maybe a company's not going to have their own footprint, but they're going to need some space sometimes. So maybe those places will flourish even more.
It does feel like a double-edged sword for WeWork in that it could benefit from companies who are looking to downsize or looking for a little bit more flexible office space. On the other hand, they're probably going to lose a lot of those two-person teams, three-person teams who previously had a desk space at WeWork, but now are just going to choose to work from home. So they maybe are going to lose some of those smaller teams of a handful of folks, but yeah, they could reap the benefits of some of these larger companies who are looking for a WeWork-like solution for some flexible office space.
There's a Chicago startup taking on Big Tobacco. Who is this and what are they doing?
Right. So this Chicago startup is called Black Buffalo, and they are operating a little similarly to how Juul and some of these vaping companies kind of operated in the smoking space. So Black Buffalo is essentially a tobacco-less dip product. So they're a smokeless product. They have nicotine in their product, but they do not. They're not made with a tobacco leaf. So they have another leafy green that they use kind of in place of the tobacco leaf. And just last week, they raised $9.75 million to kind of continue to grow within this space. So really an interesting business in Chicago. And I'm fascinated to kind of follow how they continue to grow and sort of take this Juul-like model into the smokeless tobacco space.
But you said dip, which to me is a pinch between your cheek and gum. Is it consumed that way, or is it something that I would vape?
So this is smokeless. So you're not vaping this. So this is a, you know, between your cheek and gum, exactly like you mentioned. So, you know, the comparison to Juul is that Juul took the tobacco out of its product too, and you know, leaving the nicotine. And so what the Black Buffalo is doing is something sort of similar. So it's a Juul-like product in the sense that, you know, it's ditching the tobacco to give people kind of a tobacco-free alternative to something, you know, like a traditional smokeless product.
Okay, science marches on. Who knew? So they'll infuse some kale or something, huh, with some nicotine, and I'm going to consume that, and that's going to be a thing, huh?
That's right. I mean, really what they're eyeing are, you know, folks who are trying to, you know, take tobacco out of their kind of daily routine, but still sort of, you know, want that nicotine buzz that they get kind of from their traditional dip products. You know, I was talking to the founder, and one area that Juul really got itself in trouble with was underage users. So people underage were able to get Juul, and it became a really popular, you know, activity for teenagers, right, was vaping. And so what they've been able to do is, being completely online, they've built kind of age verification software into their online checkout to make sure that you are 21 years old. So, you know, they have made a really concerted effort to really focus on traditional of age tobacco users as its primary consumer.
And one last, I guess, business I did not know there was a need for, K4 Mobility. What are they doing?
Yeah, so K4 Mobility is a startup that is bringing internet connection to yachts. So it's a really interesting business because it's actually founded by the former CEO of Gogo, which, as you know, makes the in-flight Wi-Fi for airplanes. So the former Gogo CEO now has a new business called K4 Mobility. So instead of doing airplanes, now he's heading to the seas. So K4 Mobility just last week raised $2.3 million in new venture funding. You know, interesting business. They sell to yachts, and obviously with everything kind of being shut down right now, there's not selling to a lot of folks. They're not able to kind of make those in-person connections, but the company's grown really quickly, and they hope that, you know, kind of after things settle down, that they'll continue to be in high demand.
Well, I don't have a yacht, but I know people that have boats. I mean, I guess they don't have internet connectivity out on the lake, and if they wanted, I presume this technology would work for them?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about K4 Mobility is internet on yachts is not anything new. Those boats are internet connected. But what K4 does is its product operates more efficiently. So what it does is it can swap between cell phone towers and satellites. So if you're close enough to land, you can use the Wi-Fi that you can connect to from cell phone towers. If you're way far out at sea, it seamlessly connects to the satellite connection. So it just makes the use of internet much more efficient and simpler for the boat owner. And it can also change the bandwidth. So if the boat owner is on board, they can give the boat owner about 80% bandwidth, and the crew of the boat can have about 20%. But if the owner leaves the boat, they can shift that really seamlessly to the rest of the crew.
Interesting. All right, so I'm just making a note here. Get yacht, and then get internet connectivity better. It's a 12:30. Nice to talk to you again, Jim. Let's visit on Monday next week, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at Chicago Inno. At 12:33 WGN, it's the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is maybe a topic that was best put to Elise Glink. A moment ago, I was visiting with Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. We were talking. Elise, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Oh, good. Thanks, John.
Jim and I were talking a moment ago, and Elise Glink, by the way, you can find her at thinkglink.com, Think Glink Media. She's a real estate and financial wellness expert. We were talking about what's going to happen when all of this commercial real estate in cities like Chicago finds that the tenants don't want to come back. What's going to happen to all of this office space downtown? Is it a certainty that people aren't going to come back? Elise, what's your thought about all of that?
It's interesting. I don't know that anybody is certain yet, except I did see one report from one of the big banks. They feel very strongly that within 5 years, the commercial real estate market will be booming again. And I think that seems a little optimistic, given that we don't know how this will ebb and flow. I do think there's some kinds of companies that absolutely have to operate somewhere. So think about Amazon warehouses, which they're opening up all over the country. We've got a whole bunch around here. It's very hard for Amazon to ship stuff out without a place to ship it from. Whereas office workers, I think a lot of people can work from home and maybe will choose to going forward.
Now, the point I was putting to Jim was maybe that's the sort of knee-jerk reaction to this pandemic. But if we determined that people could operate in an office building safely again, in the building that I am in right now, they're going to limit currently they only allow 4 people in the elevator at a time. There's no way you're going to be able to get people in and out if you can only have 4 people in these elevator shafts. So
yeah.
Somehow we've got to work our way past this. But if there comes a point where these buildings could operate safely and people were comfortable with it to normal capacity, I wonder if there isn't going to be a yearning to get out of the house, away from the spouse and kids and dog, and back together with your workmates. I'm imagining that there's some intrinsic value in that.
I think there's a lot of value in congregating at the office, and my employees are working from home, and I think they miss coming to the office. But it isn't even just getting the willies about getting in an elevator with people. It's also about taking public transportation and being packed together. Remember, in early days, we still saw people packed on the New York subway. The idea of even getting on a Metra or a CTA bus is frightening to a lot of people. So unless you're going to drive to the office instead of taking public transportation, or you're going to walk, I think there's going to be some concern. We're also going to probably see a reversal. Companies had started moving to downtown Chicago, as they have in downtown markets all across the country. And I think there may be renewed interest in campuses where maybe the buildings are only two or three stories tall. People can walk instead of taking elevators. There's plenty of parking and a lot of room to kind of have these walk and talk meetings outside.
You know, part of that is the same reason that some of the beaches in New York and Chicago aren't open. You say, wait a minute, why can't we go to the beaches? But in Chicago, and again, true in New York City, say, you usually have to take public transportation to get there. There's not nearly the parking to accommodate the millions of people that go to these beaches. And the way they get there is by trains, buses, by the L, say. Well, if we're not safe on the L, then it's not safe to go to the beach, even though the beach, the parkway along the beach, wide as it is, could be conceived as an open enough space to accommodate people. But how do you get the people to and from?
Right. And I think until we start to have a little bit more comfort with the idea that we can be near each other and not getting this disease, it's going to be problematic. Although the stock market is up, I'm sure you've seen this today, about 900 points so far. On the news that Moderna is reporting positive data on an early stage coronavirus vaccine trial. We are ways away from that going, 7 billion people on the planet getting it and making sure it works. But I think that that's the kind of thing that will get everybody back to their offices, back on public transportation, and back to the beaches.
When they get back to the offices, what are you hearing about the offices being reconfigured to accommodate people?
Well, it's interesting. So we work with a number of companies across the country for Best Money Moves. One of them is down south, and they are also in a tall building. They actually have several campuses, one that's three flights tall, one that's a big building, and one that's six or eight stories. And what they've been doing, senior leadership team, is really thinking very carefully about how people get to the office, once they're in the office, how they get into their spaces, how closely people are shoulder to shoulder or table to table. And some of the big steps that they've done, and I think I'm hearing other companies are doing this too, they've divided the staff into teams. They've assigned colors to them, and they're going to rotate teams in and out of the offices to make sure that there's enough people who are spaced out. They're limiting the number of people in a conference room at any one time. They've eliminated stack stations, and they've taken half the tables and chairs out of the break room, and they've put arrows on the floor for which way they want you to walk through the floors every day. And they're now testing that out with senior leadership to see if that's actually going to be, and they've got many, many other things they're looking at, but is that going to be enough to make people feel comfortable? And they're planning to have everybody come back to work in June.
I wonder if enough businesses are being that forward thinking. I think we're all waiting for the governor to say you can go back, and then you bring people back. Do you have any sense of how thorough this sort of reimagining safety or the perception of safety is in small and big businesses alike?
I think there's a lot of concern. So I'm a small business with 10 employees, and I told my team this morning on our staff meeting that we're just going to let everybody who wants to work from home work from home, like until we all feel comfortable about coming back. If you look at what companies like Accenture and some of the huge consulting companies are doing, there's so much energy with HR systems right now trying to reimagine workflow, office flow, how people connect with each other, and how everybody can feel safe enough to actually congregate again, because it's really all about how people feel safe. If they feel like if they walk outside, they're going to die, or if they walk into your office, they're going to die, they're not coming back.
And I think, Elise, that the businesses need to lay down the law such as it is, right from the get-go, because you'll have employees that don't want to wear a mask and think it's ridiculous, and you'll have people that are completely the opposite of that. And I think that the corporation needs to have a culture. Here's where we are, right? And then if you want to stay home, stay home. If you want to come into my office, come into my office. But I think they need to have some rules that people are going to follow. And I don't know that those memos have gone out yet.
I don't know. I will tell you, the one thing I think companies are not thinking enough about is the fact that if you've got kids at home and there's no summer programs and your local community centers aren't open and there's no camp and school is going to be from home in the fall, asking people to come back and just saying you've got 3 weeks to figure out a child care plan is untenable. And I think that there's a real breakdown in company think where you're like, well, we made it safe for you to come in.
Yeah.
Okay, but who's going to watch my six-year-old while I do that?
That's it. We're all waiting for the mayor and the governor. You need to think like the employee has to think about their home and their home life, because it might not be the same there, even if you're ready to bring them back here. Elise Glink, real estate and financial wellness expert, thinkglink.com. Nice to hear you, Elise. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
It's time for a Wintrust Business Minute, and this is Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Ford workers across the country are returning to work. That includes workers at the Chicago Assembly Plant and the Stamping Plant in the South Suburbs. Of course, there will be additional steps to keep workers safe, which could slow production. Sunday brunch wasn't enough to bring Uber and Grubhub to a merger agreement. The Wall Street Journal says Grubhub has rejected the latest offer from Uber, but the talks continue, and there will be more vacant storefronts in our future. That's an opportunity for a new Chicago startup. Visual Feeder is working with vacant storefront owners to turn their windows into digital ads. Chicago Inno says the ads are displayed in windows using projected mapping technology, and the end result is a full motion ad in a high traffic area. I'm Steve Bertrand. That's the Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve, I'm watching some of the numbers you are. I keep waiting for the market to start giving some of it back, but it's staying strong.
It's not at its peak for the day, but it's still up there. 882 points, the NASDAQ up 232, and the S&P 500 up 92.
Orion Samuelson, what are you seeing today?
I'm seeing a mixed market, but not much change in the agricultural commodity trade. Let's look at the Board of Trade first of all. July wheat is down 2.25 cents a bushel. July corn is up a penny a bushel. And July soybeans trading up 5.5 cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the June lean hog contract down 27 cents a hundredweight. The June live cattle contract is up $1.40, and the May feeder cattle contract is up $1.92 a hundredweight. This afternoon's weekly planting progress report could be interesting. My neighbors about a mile from my house in McHenry County probably won't be doing any planting, because in my rain gauge in McHenry the past 3 days, a total of 7.78 inches, that's 7.75 almost, of rain fallen, and that'll certainly put a stop to the planters rolling in muddy fields, which is certainly what we have in a large part of the Midwest. So the planting progress reports this afternoon should be interesting. And finally, despite the pandemic, one segment of American agricultural producers will have a new market for its product. We do have professional bison producers in the United States. So we have the National Bison Association. And they got news over the weekend that the government of Mexico has formally opened its doors to imported U.S.-produced bison meat into that country. The move formally opens the doors to a new market for U.S. bison meat. And according to Dave Carter, executive director of the National Bison Association, this is a very positive development for the bison business. The Mexican marketplace offers a growth opportunity for our product. Additionally, many consumers in Mexico tend to favor cuts of meat that are not in high demand by U.S. customers, so this can help the market balance the utilization of the product from American bison producers, a new market for that livestock commodity. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
1249 now, and Amy Guth joins us with lots of stories, Amy, so I'm going to sprint you through these, and I'm not going to start with the most important one, but one that I teased earlier, and that is the price paid for a pair of Air Jordan sneakers on the heels of that Last Dance documentary on ESPN.
That's right. So Sotheby's Auction House thought that these might fetch $150,000. These were worn in 1985 during a game. Michael Jordan autographed them. And instead of $150,000, they fetched $560,000 in an online auction. It was open. People, about 10 bidders from around the world, all placed their bets. But then once the thing closed yesterday, that was the price, which is unbelievable. And the pair came from somebody who has a museum. His name is Jordan Geller. He's the founder of Sneaker Museum, Shoezeum, which is in Vegas. He was the collector that sold the pair, and so he has $560,000 more than he had before.
So this is a game-worn, autographed, year-one pair of Air Jordans that Michael wore in a game.
That's right. That's right. So not an insignificant find for a collector or a Michael Jordan fan, for sure. But, you know, I thought it was an interesting timing thing. You know, every Sunday night we've seen Michael Jordan and other Bulls players trend because of the Last Dance. And as people have been watching episodes, they're tweeting about it, things like that. And so this is kind of a piece of that that might have flown a bit under some people's radar when so many people were talking about the show. 6 million people a week tuned into that show. So some major pull there for ESPN showing that docuseries.
Still, I would be in so much trouble.
I know. Right? For sure. That's a lot of money. Even the $150,000 that the Sotheby's thought it might fetch is an astronomical amount. But this also broke a record. It was previously also held by Sotheby's, and it was around $470,000 range for a pair of Nike moon shoes last year. And this has broken that record.
The founder of Mariano's is back in the game?
That's right. So Bob Mariano, he is back in the game. He has a $10 million investment, and he's looking to build what he's calling the next generation of grocery stores. So that is a smaller format store. It's got take-home and dine-in stuff. It has specialty foods. It has groceries. And it has meal kits that are available for delivery. So he's trying to kind of answer the moment that we're in, but also kind of look at what does grocery behavior look like and what will it be in the future. So this first one is going to be in Lincoln Park. He says there will be others after that one is up and running. But he's partnered with some players in this space that I think are really interesting. So he's got the $10 million investment, as I said, but he's working with Jay Owen and Don Fitzgerald. Jay Owen is the grandson of Dominic's founder, Dominic DeMatteo, and Don Fitzgerald, he was a former executive with Mariano at Roundy's when Mariano was CEO and chairman. Of course, Kroger bought out Mariano's in 2015. Bob Mariano retired about a year later after a lot of pressure for some consolidations, things like that. But there's been a lot of mounting consumer criticism in the last couple of years that, hey, Kroger's really changed Mariano. It's not special anymore. You don't have, you know, you can't walk around and shop and drink wine or have oysters or whatever. It's having more of their kind of generic brand, private label, things like that, more checkout lanes. So a lot of people, there's been a lot of backlash on some of the store remodels and things like that. So we'll see what happens here. But that investment, part of that is led by Cleveland Avenue. And that is from former McDonald's CEO Don Thompson, who's also an investor in Beyond Meat and Farmer's Fridge, which you know might have seen those cool like salad vending machines locally. So I think this has a lot of potential. It's a really interesting idea of someone kind of rising to the occasion of what groceries are supposed to look like now and what behavior is. What I think will be interesting is we've seen things like Foxtrot Market and stuff like that answering kind of the really high end of the market. It'll be interesting to see, is this high end? Is this medium tier? Where does this fall in the price point?
And this won't be called Mariano's. This will be called Dom's Market and Kitchen?
That's right. Dom's Market and Kitchen, I'm sure, homage there to the Dominick's line. But it'll be interesting. I mean, these are three players that really know, you know, they have a lot of experience combined in that grocery space. And it'll be interesting to see what they roll out. They're aiming for March of 2021, so it's not happening just yet. But it certainly sounds like from the company that once that first store hits, they're going to be placing some other ones around the city, really focusing on urban areas. So it doesn't sound like there's any plans for any in the suburbs at this point.
Lincoln Park seems like a logical place for that. Bike sales, exercise cycles, I would imagine treadmills. I suppose that whole category is exploding right now.
Yeah, and so here's some data about it. And that is, so bike sales in March were up by 50% from last year. And that's according to the market research firm NPD Group. They looked at a lot of data. If you include stationary exercise bikes, sales are up 31% in the first quarter, which, you know what, once you see that data, you're like, that makes perfect sense. People are at home. They're trying to find ways to fill that gap and fill the need that maybe a gym or a yoga studio or something like that happened, maybe filled. And so they're like, what can I do? As you said, treadmills, stationary bikes, biking around, things like that are a way to fill that void. So that's one area when we're seeing so many areas of industry that have been so badly impacted, so many areas of retail that have been so badly impacted, bike shops. Now, 20 to 30% of bike shops have been closed as stay-home orders were rolled out. And so bike employees, NPR talked to several of them on All Things Considered after the release of this data, and a lot of them were kind of trying to figure out, well, what does that mean to work in a bike shop and service a bike and sell someone a bike? Staying far away from them, what does that look like? So that's another industry that's trying to figure that out. But they're having this moment where a lot of people are buying their bikes, which is not a tiny purchase, right? That's $600 to $1,500 right in there. You know, that's kind of your mid-market right there. Certainly some of them are a lot more. But a lot of people are calling kind of this mini bike boom moment that we're in. So we'll see how that holds as we get into summer months. Some states are, you know, talking about opening gyms under certain social distancing guidelines, things like that. But for now, really good news for the bike companies.
Yeah, I know some people are having trouble finding, you know, even if you find the item you want, a lot of the items online are sold out. On 60 Minutes last night, Jerome Powell, I don't know if he made news, but people are talking about what he said. What's a takeaway from you on Jerome Powell?
Yeah, so, you know, he said a lot of interesting things over the last couple of weeks, but last night on 60 Minutes, he said, you know, it's going to be bad, but he doesn't see the economy entering into another Great Depression. He doesn't think it'll be that bad. He does think that the rebound won't take long. He hasn't been too optimistic about like the so-called V-shaped recovery and that it will crash hard and bounce back quickly, but he doesn't think it'll be super long. But of course, super long in Jerome Powell language is more along the lines of like a year. You know, he's not talking about months. He's talking about a little bit longer time than that. I think the big takeaway is when looking at GDP, because in the United States, so much of GDP is built around consumer spending. And I mean, 70% of it is counting on us to go out and spend money. So in that note, he said he really feels like that it could be the case that the GDP could shrink about, you know, in the 20-30%, like that's a pretty big, you know, percentage there to see. But when you think about how much of it is based on consumer spending, it makes a lot of sense. But anytime you hear Jerome Powell kind of lay something out, it's, you know, here's someone who has a lot of data, who has a big vantage point to the economy, of course, as a Federal Reserve chair. So, you know, we have to pay attention when he's talking. Most recently, last week, he said 2 in 5 people who make less than $40,000 a year have lost that income. So there's another piece that he's pointing to there for that GDP.
I've repeated that statistic more than once. That one was alarming. But the markets are doing well today. It's good to hear Amy Gu. Thanks for your time today, Amy.
Thanks so much, Jim.